Racing HQ is brought to you by TAB. Get a bonus bet up to $50 for second and third on selected races this weekend. Gamble responsibly.
Great the chinwag with John O'Shea. Good morning, John.
Morning, Cozzy. How are you, mate?
I'm good. I'm just firstly, he had a few trial this morning. Beautifully bred horse there. Significance in the fifth. He ran a nice trial behind Catch Me.
Yeah, no, he's a nice young staying conveyance. Should be a nice horse in the spring. So just about getting some miles under his legs without overstressing him as a two-year-old. And yeah, he did a good job this morning. So might take him off to the races and give him a start.
He's by Frankel. He's had a trial over 1,050. You gave him another one today, which I think was, not a shorty either. With this bloke, how far do you reckon he'll get? Because the Frankel, some of them are getting a bit of ground, John. They're staying pretty well, aren't they?
Yeah, look, he's got a very stout French pedigree under him. So I don't think it'll be any issue getting over a bit of ground. He's got, three strains of Danzig in his pedigree. So that sort of might hopefully speed him up a little bit. But traditionally, I think the Frankels are staying and throwing back to Galileo, grand sire. So, hopefully this fellow, ideally, will go around some nice races in the spring as a three-year-old.
It's interesting with the Northern Hemisphere breed sometime. Galileo came down here and stood at stud, and I don't know whether we didn't know how to train and whatever, but they went shocking, most of them down here that we had a crack with. But yet you get the Northern Hemisphere horses, and they go well, don't they?
Yeah, look, I think Galileo probably... it was a bit of our fault, not his. I think he's such a good stallion that, it's just probably the way we trained them, tried to make two-year-olds of them as we do with everything else. And I think he went to stud at the same time as Encosta de Largo. And the majority of Dane Hill mares at Coolmore at that time probably went to Encosta instead of Galileo. And as you saw with Frankel, every time Galileo saw Dane Hill, he made a pretty fair horse of it. So I think if you had the time over, we might have done a little bit smarter and he probably would have been just as successful down here as he was in Europe.
Now, you've had a lot of practice training international horses, those that have come from overseas. Do you have to train them differently?
I think not necessarily, Cozzy. I think the thing that, from my experience anyway, where they've been so successful in this country is that we feed them a bit better. And when they come down here, they've been sort of had a really good base of fitness put into them. And so then it's just a matter of keeping them fresh and keeping a bit of speed in their legs and, they do the rest themselves. So, I definitely didn't overtrain them and found that just by putting a little condition on them and keeping a bit of speed in their legs, they're just as effective.
It seems in England in particular that they're on their back for a fair while when they work them of a morning. By the time they walk them out, do their work, come back. We don't have that luxury really here, do we, to be able to do that?
No, we don't, and that's probably an area of our industry that we need to rectify in the coming years. The concept of training horses round circles at 4 o'clock in the mornings for the fairies, they're an animal that likes to be in a relaxed environment. I think for the betterment of our industry, it'd be better that we trained away from the metropolitan area so that the staff on what, termed predominantly minimum wage, having compelled to live in the dearest real estate in Australia is almost ludicrous. So, I think that they'd have a much better quality of life if they were allowed to sort of train in the country areas and get out of bed at a reasonable hour as opposed to the 3:30 where they start now. So there's a lot of things that we could probably learn from the Europeans in terms of training horses that would make things a lot more effective here.
It's an interesting point, John. You don't see many trained to the centre of London, do you? They're all out in the gallops, on the downs and so forth, out of town.
Yeah, and then it only makes sense, mate. I think it's becoming increasingly difficult to get, young people want to work or get out of bed at 3 a.m. And I think one of the reasons is that, financially they're at such a disadvantage having to live in the middle of Sydney and work for what they do. So the way to increase the real value of their wage is to have them trained in an area where it doesn't cost them as much to live.
The other point too is when you look at those gallops on the way out to Bath in England there, I mean, they're often working on almost pristine ground on some parts of it, aren't they?
Yeah, a lot of times, they gallop on areas that haven't been galloped on since last year. And it only makes sense, mate. Horses don't necessarily need a rail to follow. So, the way they do it is they have a big paddock and put the markers out and they will soon work out where the best ground is,
And a lot of them tend to work pretty much in a straight line. It's got to be better for horses with dicky legs.
Well, it increases their soundness. You know, like a good friend of mine always has the saying that, you know, horses go around in circles, a lot of dogs chasing cars. There's not a real future in it. And I think there's a lot of merit to that.
They've had a lot of success at Ballarat, where they put that synthetic track in that goes up the hill, the straight track there. They love that.
Yeah, just a nice incline, not overly, you know. And I know Darren Weir, any conversation I'd had with him over it previously, thought that, you know, his veterinary, Bill Harve, once they put that straight gallop in, and it only makes sense, you know, that running in a straight line is to the betterment of the horse.
Now, John, growing up as a kid in Mareeba in North Queensland, did you ever think you'd be doing this?
Not in my wildest dreams.
Tell us about Mareeba as a kid growing up.
Oh, mate, it's sort of, you know, it's very north and very dry and only a very small town, large indigenous population there, sort of, I mean, you know, when you grow up in North Queensland, you sort of go to the races on Saturday and go to the football on Sunday, and that's pretty much your life, you know. So it is a great time, you know. I'll always be grateful for it.
Going to school, you must have liked school because you went to uni afterwards eventually, but did you like school as a little bloke, or was uni just a way to meet girls and fill in time?
Well, uni was just an excuse to get out of Mareeba, to be honest, because it's so... I couldn't wait to get away from the joint. But, I think the biggest thing is, you know, you got to make a decision when you're so young these days at 17 what you want to do for the rest of your life. So for me, it was an excuse to go to university and give consideration of what I may want to do for the next 3 years while I was sort of, you know, furthering my education.
It's interesting the point you make that at 17 you've got to decide what you're going to do. I got a son, 25, and a daughter just 19. And I said to him, you know, have a look at people you know and ask them what they thought they'd do at 15, what they were doing at 21, and what they're doing at 30. And you often get three different answers.
Yeah, I've got two young boys at the moment, one's 25, one's 18. And, I think the biggest thing for them is to find something that they enjoy and they're passionate about. And, you know, you'll always work significantly better when you sort of feel strong about something. So, you know, whatever that may be, that they'll make their own decisions. But I just try to encourage them to find something that they're really passionate about and that they want to work long and hard at.
Now, as a kid growing up, you mentioned going to the races on a Saturday. Was your family background racing? Did they have horses? Were they trainers? Anything like that?
Mate, my father was lucky enough to be able to afford to own quite a few of them. And, you know, we come from a bookmaking family. My grandfather was a bookmaker in the Cane Fields and Mossman. So, you know, racing was sort of something that our family did a lot of for a long time. So, that's where I got the enjoyment out of it. And I just used to live, eat and breathe horse racing and rugby league predominantly.
Now, from the horse racing point of view, is the career as a jockey ever on the horizon?
Mate, I could never make the under-40s rugby league team when I was about 10, so I could never consider making a jockey.
Running a book at school? Any of those sorts of rorts going on?
No, just we've always punt. We punt like the Watsons, you know. Like so, but I never run a book. I was never that good at maths, mate.
So, when you left school, I believe you mucked out boxes for the local trainers. Was that just something to get involved in racing, or was it a bit of pocket money?
Yeah, mate, I used to do it at school. You know, from probably about 11 or 12 on, just riding a bike into town every day and going and work at the stables and, you know, the art of picking up manure, and which is stood me in good stead later on in life, you know. So, you know, like I say, you know, young kids these days probably don't have that luxury because of the restrictions around occupational health and safety. But, you know, that's where I learned, you know, to get involved in the game and be always very grateful of it.
It was a good time picking up the dung, wasn't it? The old split chaff bag, and sometimes you'd have a bit of a fork, and quite often the fork was on the end of your arm, your hands.
Yeah, no, mate, there's nothing wrong about it. Just teach you a good work ethic at a young age, you know.
Yeah, it's a tough cape, isn't it? It would have been at that age.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, the game itself is very, very, you know, demanding, and there's the issue, I suppose, for young trainers is that, you know, there's so many variables that you have no control over that affect the result at the end of the day, and sometimes when you're young and it's very hard to comprehend that, you know, and so it's not for the faint-hearted, and you've got to have an extreme passion for it, because the reality is that it's not all plain sailing, and, you know, not everyone can come to terms with the adversity that you have to face as a young trainer, you know.
I'm chin wagging with John O'Shea. I ought to be very nervous, John, because you graduated with a degree in journalism. I failed HSC, and at the end of this interview, you can probably give me a score out of 10 because you've got far better qualifications than me, I'll tell you.
Yeah, mate, I'm not very good at it, though. So I think the only reason I got to graduate is that the only way I got to stay at uni was to continue to pass. So because the funds would have dried up significantly quickly for Mareeba had I not passed. So that always was a great inspiration to continue to study.
Did you play a bit of rugby league in Toowoomba when you were there at uni?
Yeah, I played for a club called Newtown, and which is now defunct, unfortunately. But, you know, the mates we met there were still in contact with, and that was some great days, you know. Like, as you will well appreciate, Cozzy Rugby League in Toowoomba is a big deal, and that's how I sort of, a lot of the way I funded my way through university was, you know, they were very good players, and so I was lucky enough to be able to be paid to play, and it made sure I could eat every week at while I was at uni.
It was a strong league area there with Pittsworth and Oakey and those sort of towns involved as well around the Darling Downs, and they used to produce a lot of top-class league players who go on and represent Australia.
Yeah, well, most of the young fellas that, you know, I played with were all sort of, you know, the first or second-year Broncos, Michael Hancock, and that was Stanthorpe at the time, and they all went on to play the Broncos the following year. So, you know, like you say, it was a great nursery for the rugby league in Queensland, but it was a very tough, uncompromising league, and you soon learned how to hold your hands up very quickly there.
They were passionate about it. I on a grand final once when I was working on radio there, John, I lost a bet, and I had to run up the main street of Pittsworth on the Monday wearing a ladies' nighty. Now, that would have been a sight
for sore eyes, Cozzy. I've got to say, I'm glad I missed that one.
Mate, that was enough to make mice jump on traps, and the whole town turned out. The mongrels got the fire brigade out. They hosed me down, and they finished up, chained me to a parking meter. I didn't look like getting out of town. And it was just, there was a party on, and I was going to be part of it, whether I liked it or not. I escaped. I saw a friend I knew. I said, have you got a car? I said, I'm going to make out I'm going to the loo, back it up out the back. I jumped in and put carpet over me, and I got away that way. But they were quite passionate about it. Now, training. You finished up with Tommy Smith, as working there with Tommy in about 1995. How did that come about?
Oh, mate, I was badly injured playing league and sort of thought that it was better things to do in life, and I was always at a few horses and work anyway. And to be honest, I just decided to come down to Sydney for some tuition and, you know, maybe spend 6 months with Gay and TJ, and, mate, I just never went home. So I rang Gay up one day. I watched her at the Magic Millions and sort of said, look, is there any chance of getting a gig? And she was kind enough to give me a job as a strapper, and away I went.
So you had horses and work prior to that. Was that in Toowoomba?
No, in Cairns. Yeah.
In Cairns, so, up north before you come down.
Yep.
So it would have been amazing, I reckon, working with TJ Smith and Gay Waterhouse at the time.
Oh, that time was great because, you know, obviously Gay had a proliferation of, you know, serious Group 1 horses, things like Pharaoh. You know, she won, you know, Doncasters and used to have 7 runners in the Metropolitan every year. Yeah, it was a really interesting time. It was the time, you know, Shane Dye was the stable rider then, and you know, if you kept your eyes open and your mouth shut, you learn plenty.
And I would imagine every box you walked into and put a head collar on wanted to be a group horse.
Yeah, mate, there was some serious, you know, like things like Nothing Like a Dane, and, you know, like the list went on and on and on. So it was always a very exciting Tuesday morning in the lead up to the carnivals, going to the gallops, because, you know, there was plenty of great horses there to watch and give consideration to over the week.
John, what was the best horse you looked after when you were there?
I looked after Electronics. He won a Metropolitan and a filly called Assert of Lass, who won Coolmore and White Stakes. So, yeah, no, they were two great horses.
She was a full sister to Assert of Lad. I think it was a very good gallop as well.
Yeah, she was knee-high to a grasshopper. And, really good filly.
Now, you also worked with Bart Cummings. You had a stint there.
Yeah, I think fundamentally, you know, to go and work with Bart was sort of, you know, something I always wanted to do. He was sort of my idol, and I got an opportunity to spend some time with him while Sean Dwyer was the foreman there. And, you know, the best thing about Bart is that he always wanted you to think like he did, so he would tell you, you know, what he loved you sitting down and asking questions. So Having spent 2 or 3 years with TJ and Gay, I was sort of knew what I was looking for, and so I could have the opportunity to sit down and chat with him was great, and sort of he probably had the greatest influence on me as a trainer, you know. So, he's a great guy. I love being around him.
They say his greatest virtue, I suppose, was patience. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and he never got flustered. You know, like he was always same temper, you know, all, the whole time, and irrespective of the performance of the horse, you know, he was a great intellect and thought a great deal about what he was doing, and, you know, he's passed that on to young James now, and you can see that, you know, those guys that listened a lot to what he had to say sort of been the beneficiary of the information that he'd be wanting to pass on.
John, having worked with those people back then, do you think these days sometimes we try and overanalyze what we're doing?
Yeah, I suppose just the age we live in, Quasi. I think, you know, it's an information highway now, and sometimes I think too much information is not a good thing, particularly if they don't know how to decipher it. But I think, you know, and this believe probably be somewhat held down in Victoria, but I think one of the reasons why the culture in New South Wales in terms of, you know, treatment of horses is what it is I think a lot of it's attributed to, you know, most of the young trainers that come through New South have all worked for Bart and TJ at some stage, and you learnt that, you know, to get a result, it's fundamentally hard work and good feed and a good horse and looking after those horses and attention to detail. And I think they've formulated the culture in New South Wales as a result and consequently we're the beneficiary of that, you know.
Now, did you work with Gary Moore at one stage?
Yeah, I spent about 18 months with Gaz, you know, like when he first came back to Sydney. Mm-hmm. And he's a really interesting guy and always be, you know, great mates. And we had a great time, to be honest. We had some nice horses, and it was Gaz that started his training career. And it was a really good time because he had some nice horses and got some good results as well.
Is he the most exuberant trainer you've ever worked with when he wins a race? Because he can carve it out when he wins, can't he?
Mate, I can tell you a story. One time we went to Toowoomba, believe it or not, put a $100,000 mare's race on. And Jimmy came up and rode it, Jimmy Cassidy, and it arrived in the last bound. And Gaz got that excited that he jumped the fence and ran down chasing after the horse, clapping and cheering. But what he forgot is that the top straight at Toowoomba is 38 feet higher than the bottom straight. And he ran down the bottom chasing and looked up and then realised he had to run all the way back up and nearly missed the presentation. It took him that long. So he's a great man, Gaz. It was never boring.
No, that's right. As you said, that track in Toowoomba, I used to find a few out. Some who'd raced on flat tracks had come there. And you'd think they were a better bet than death, and they'd get to the turn, the big white flag, and unfurl.
Yeah, no, they need to be nice and fit getting up that hill, you know.
Right. When you decided to go out on your own, how difficult was it to get owners?
Oh, mate, it was just a battle, you know. Like, but I was there for the grind. I think we started with 5 horses and just gradually battled away through it. Had some good, loyal clients, and most of them are still there now, and you know, a horse called Grey and Gold got me started, and then I bought an old horse called Mushtaq, and you know, to be able to go to the races and train a winner on a Saturday at that stage of your career was a big help. And so, they were instrumental in getting me started.
Would have been nice to get horses like Charge Ford come along.
Yeah, no, to buy Charge Ford as a yearling and then obviously have, you know, successful young colt was great. And, you know, Private Steer, they're also very helpful. And once you've got those sort of horses coming through your joint and you're able to train a few Group 1 winners, got an old horse going called Shot of Thunder. He won a Group 1. All those sort of horses got me going. And, you know, I've been lucky to have been able to buy some nice horses as yearlings that weren't overly dear. And, you know, if you can always do that, you can always find yourself a winner and get a quid.
I think it was Shot of Thunder won a Toorak, didn't he?
He did, yep.
Yeah, that would have been a good kick along. To win one interstate, a Group 1 interstate.
Yeah, no, it was a good result because we ducked out of I didn't take him to the Epsom because I thought it was too hard and got Bossy to go down and ride him in the track and got the job done, you know. So we had a great day that day. I thought he could win, so I asked a good few mates of mine who'd come down and they'd help me get started and they were all there for it. So it was a really good day.
Private Steer, how would you rank her amongst the horses you've trained?
Our best horse I've ever trained. By a country mile.
Fair dinkum. And that includes the ones you had at Godolphin?
Yep. No. Superstar.
Gee, that's a fair rap.
Yeah.
Why?
No, Oh, mate, she's had a great turn of foot. She's a cripple. You know, when she won a Doncaster, she beat Grand Army. So, so I would have loved to have run her at a Cox Plate because I think she'd have been very hard to beat. She loved that sort of ground, you know, that forgiving ground. So, but they never got to beat, but she had a tremendous record and we'll always be grateful for her, for what she did for me.
How did you come by her? Did you buy her?
Mate, no. She was in work with, I think, Leroy Curtis, and the owners decided to, they wanted to move her after she ran the Magic Millions at the Gold Coast. So chap rang me up to take her and, you know, started for me at a first start over the Easter Carnival. You know, she ran in the PJ Bell and went on one of Stradbroke two starts later.
You say she was a cripple. What was wrong with her?
She had arthritic knee. That's why she was always so very effective on wet ground, you know.
Mm. With the need the give, bit of sting out of it.
Loved a bit of sting in the ground. Yeah.
Mm. Now, at Godolphin, you trained some great horses there. Which would you rank as the best at Godolphin?
Obviously, the best homebred was a Stern. He was a, you know, a freak of a horse. He was a superstar from the first day we put a bridle on him. And, you know, it was a shame he was a horse, probably never quite reached, you know, albeit he won a Group 1, but he was a horse that continually had viral issues. You know, every preparation, he'd end up with a temperature of some description for whatever reason, and that ultimately curtailed his career. But yeah, he was a very special colt. And, he was from day one, he was very, very good. And after that, of course, Hartnell, there was, you know, he's always been a very special horse to me. He was a real character, and, you know, he's still going so very well for the organisation now, you know. I loved every minute we got to take him to the races because he was just a real character of a horse and a great horse to be around at home.
Must have been an amazing experience training for Godolphin, because every horse that walked into the place would have been beautifully bred.
Yeah, it's the most enjoyable 3 years I had as a, you know, as a trainer in terms of quality of horse, and we loved it. I loved every minute of it, you know, loved every minute of it.
I saw a quote at the end where you said when you pulled the pin, you're exhausted. Was it mental exhaustion?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me is that, you know, like, I think the telling point was when we won the Doncaster with it somewhat, and I remember walking up the tunnel with Darren, and I just got no thrill out of it, you know, and it was like winning a maiden at Canterbury, you know, and I think that was the beginning of the end, you know. So it was just a surreal feeling that, you know, I can remember winning Doncasters previously where you walked on air for the next sort of 2 months, you know, and so that was probably enough, you know, at that stage that I'd probably realise that, you know, it was probably time to do something else.
So you had a break for a while, pulled the pin, just cleared the air?
A few bits and pieces, and, you know, it was a good time, spend time with my kids. I've never done that, take my kids to school and just get involved in whatever they were doing, and, you know, I think by the end of it, my wife was happy that I went back to work. you know, it was probably something, you know, I've never been able to do that. And that's sort of special to me. So, you know, I was very grateful of it.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned your wife, because from the rough, tough rugby league player, decking them on the footy field, you're a big sook. Tell us how you proposed to your wife. This is a good yarn, this.
Oh, mate, she was, she's from, obviously from Quebec, and I obviously met her when I was on a skiing trip over there, and very lucky that she was tolerant enough to put up with me. When I did ask her to marry me, she said yes, and then had a bit of a thing about it and said, oh, might be a bit much, but eventually I swayed her to reconsider, and the rest is history.
You pursued her, your dad, you would have had a few bomb and airfares, wouldn't you?
Yeah, no, back and forth every sort of, you know, 12 months. And, I just knew she was the one for me. So I was punching well above my weight. And I'm reminded of that by my friends all the time. So it's better to be on that team than the other one, I can tell you. So, I'm very, very, very lucky. I mean, without her, wife wouldn't be there living. So she's been an absolute rock for me.
It's a good story. You just met on the skiing trip and that was it. You were gone straight away. Get the hammer out, knock him down. Finished.
Yeah, from that day on, mate. So, probably would have been married a bit sooner if she would have followed me. I asked her to obviously follow me around America with me at that stage and she wouldn't come. But I wore her down eventually, cause
persistence pays off, John, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it's a good lesson in life.
Now, what have you got at the moment that we can find maybe a winner or two in the next couple of weeks? Have you got anything lined up that we think we should have something on?
Mate, look, I probably, I've got a group of young horses predominantly. Yeah. I mean, 90% of the stable are all two-year-olds. So, but I've got a young horse, I've got two young colts, I think, that will, over the next 12 months, be very effective when it comes to top line racing. And there's a colt called Dormier who ran at Newcastle last week, who's now in the paddock. I think he's got a very, very bright future. There's a colt called Significance who trialled today, yeah, led his first run at Newcastle next Thursday. Again, he'll have a really bright future over 2,000 metres in the spring. And the, probably the other colt to follow would be a horse called Sea of Life, who will trial on Monday and probably have a run of some description over the autumn. And I would think that he'll be a really top chance in a Coolmore or something like that in the spring. So they're probably the three horses in the next 12 months that, if we're going to be effective at the top level, that we're doing the job for us.
Mm. Another nice mare. You got one the other day all over Bossa Nova, knocked over the Camarina at Canberra. She's a lovely honest mare.
Really good little honest mare. She backs up again on Saturday, predominantly because we knew the weather was coming. And I think that mares that have been out of form or haven't won for a while, once they do get themselves back in the winner's circle, I'm a great advocate that, you know, they can put a couple together. And she's in great form. She's found a nice race on Saturday, which is about 8 or 10 to 1. She would get a toe in the ground where she's a lot more effective, and she's down the weight. So, yeah, she'll give a good account of herself at double figure odds.
Another filly you had won the other day at Wyong. It's taken a little while to break through. Had 6 months. Pop Girl, has she got a bit of upside?
Yeah, no, she went straight to the paddock next day, and then she'll find her way back into the stable next week and then head to Brisbane for, you know, those races like the Gold Coast Bracelet. And being that the Oaks is around Doomed and it's not a hard 10 furlongs, so she might even end up there.
All right. John, great to catch up. Thank you for having a chin wag with me. It's always good to catch up. And good luck, too, through the autumn.
Thanks very much, Buzzy, and best of luck to all your listeners. Cheers, mate.